Good morning. I don't know about you, but in the last few weeks, I've really not wanted to watch the news. The news often feels bad, but recently, bad has got a whole lot worse. We have the unending nightmare of Syria, a belligerent Russia, and a new American leader who is unproven and unpredictable. The defense pact the West has depended on for decades suddenly looks less secure. And then there's terrorism. Yes, ISIS may be on the defensive militarily, but will this stop the barbaric attacks of the last 12 months? Paris, Orlando, Nice. Then, in the wake of terror, has come fear. And with fear, we look for people to blame. And suddenly, whole groups of innocent people feel scared of being picked on. Refugees and migrants stream across the globe, and there is talk of building walls. Nearer to home, in what we'd like to hope is our more stable society, at least two of our political parties have come close to imploding this year as the EU referendum revealed a more deeply divided nation than any of us imagined. What Brexit will mean, no one seems to know. All we do know is that foreign holidays just got more expensive and the possible breakup of the UK hasn't gone away. So, change, uncertainty, the unknown. Unimaginable horror striking out of a clear blue sky, as it did for one of our brightest MPs, simply walking to work. No, I don't like watching the news anymore. Members of my family have been having nightmares. We live in hostile times, and deep in the subconscious, there is fear. Our current sermon series on Daniel, chapters 1 to 6, has the title Fearless Living in Hostile Times. Could we have the first image, please? So, not fearful, but fearless. Just what we need, by the sound of it. What does it mean to be deeply, authentically fearless when there might be a fiery furnace round the corner? How do Christians, increasingly a threatened minority, know true peace when there are enemies at the gate? King Belshazzar, ruler of the later Babylonian Empire, seemed unconcerned about the threat he faced. So, we are in the city of Babylon. Let's see, that's there. It's near Baghdad in modern Iraq in the year 539 BC. And the ruler of this greatest city, the New York of its time, has enemies at the gate. These are the Medes and Persians, or as we might say now, Iran. With a million subjects, the new Babylonians had been the powerhouse of the time, and as we remember from the beginning of our series, had invaded the holy lands of the Jews, sacked Jerusalem and its temple, and carried back prisoners that included the young Daniel and his friends. That was 70 years before, and the Babylonian king then was Nebuchadnezzar. It was Nebuchadnezzar that the exile Daniel had served for decades as trusted official and ambassador of the living God. It was for Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel had interpreted a troubling dream showing the future collapse of his empire, as Martin explained to us a few weeks ago. But now, 23 years after Nebuchadnezzar's death, the co-regent of the empire is Belshazzar. We just forward, please. And the next one, thank you. This is what Belshazzar might have looked like. And the elderly Daniel, still in exile, has been forgotten. In seconds, the Bible account skims over the years since Nebuchadnezzar and arrives abruptly at this moment when Belshazzar stands at the brink of defeat. But the king seems unconcerned. It is party night in Babylon, and Belshazzar is the host. We have the Greek historian Herodotus to tell us why Belshazzar was so casual about the Medes and the Persians at his gates. The city was considered impregnable. Its walls were 60 miles in circumference, 150 feet high, and were deep enough for four chariots to drive abreast around the ramparts. The city boasted 20 years of food reserves and a supply of fresh water from the river Euphrates, which flowed through its midst. Yet enemies were prevented from using the river to breach the city by ingenious underwater defenses. When first I read the account of Belshazzar drinking the night away as the Persian armies approached, I assumed he was a measly coward, drowning his terrors in wine, knowing he would die on the morrow. But digging deeper, it's clear this was an act of supreme arrogance. Belshazzar hosts this national feast for 1,000 guests in a show of brazen pride. What enemies? He seems to be saying. Babylon has no enemies, only victims. And to make the point, he calls for the vessels captured from the temple in Jerusalem and proceeds to drink from them in riotous hilarity. As the liquor flows, Belshazzar uses these sacred cups to toast the gods of metal and stone, and in this one blasphemous act, seals his doom. These temple vessels were dedicated to the worship of the one God. Now they are defiled by foul idolatry. God is blatantly mocked and profaned, and probably even those watching are taken back. Belshazzar has gone a step too far. If there is one thing that God detests, the Bible makes clear that it is idolatry, worshipping false gods. And when Belshazzar publicly jeers at God, as he does here, the divine restraint finally snaps. So, bullet point number one from this passage is Belshazzar's arrogance. The phrase, the writing on the wall, has come to mean any portent of doom. It's one of many idioms in the English language that come from the Bible. In this, its original context, a disembodied hand writes four words on the wall of the banqueting hall, and Belshazzar is instantly reduced to a terrified wreck. Archaeology has confirmed that three of the walls in this part of the palace were rendered in white plaster, and it would have been on one of these that were mysteriously written the words, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Peres. These were words in the Aramaic language used by the Babylonians, but they were so cryptic as to be unintelligible. Transfixed, Belshazzar turns mechanically to the religion of to his religion for an explanation. But the wizards are as clueless as he is. The king is now consumed with terror, and his guests must think he's having a heart attack. Summoned by the uproar, the queen enters, probably not his wife, but his mother. And it is she who reminds Belshazzar of Daniel, the clever foreigner who has displayed unearthly wisdom so often in the past. He's the one to solve the riddle. When Daniel went early to bed that night, he could have had no idea of the momentous role he would be called upon to fulfill before the night was out. He's in his 80s. He's been on the shelf for years, shunted to some bureaucratic backwater. The king has forgotten he even exists. But this man has been schooled in the razor-sharp discipline of the Lord all his life. So when he is hauled, sleepy-eyed, before the jabbering ruler, his spiritual instincts are sure and true. Gifts and rewards? No, the king can keep them. He's not going to profit from the honor of serving his God. He may be a cast-off Jew whose God the king has just maligned, but Daniel is not for hire. The ghostly message? Well, Mene means numbered. Your time's up. And it's repeated for emphasis. Tekel means that you have been weighed and found wanting. And Peres, interpreted by a clever play on words, means that your kingdom will go to the Medes and Persians. Why? Your predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, had to learn the hard way that God is in charge. God gave him his power and for a period disciplined him for his arrogance. As a result, Nebuchadnezzar came to revere God for who he is. You knew all this, but you never listened. Not ignorant, but insolent. You set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. Instead of glorifying your Maker, you have blasphemed against him. And tonight, you have seen his verdict. So, point number one was Belshazzar's arrogance. Point number two, Daniel's courage. Confronted with this devastating message, you really might think that Belshazzar would stop in his tracks. For one compassionate moment, he has the chance to fall on his knees and plead for mercy. But remarkably, given how petrified he was minutes before, he pushes blindly on, showering Daniel with unwanted gifts, ignoring everything he has heard. The story of the writing of the wall is that we don't listen. And all this time, the Persian armies of Darius have been diverting one of the waterways that come into Babylon so that they can advance along a dried-up riverbed under the very walls of the city. By dawn, as Herodotus confirms, Babylon has fallen and Belshazzar is dead. God's judgment has struck, and not just the king, but the followers he should have been leading. None of us should want Belshazzar's brand of fearlessness. Relying solely on the strength of man, whether it's chariots or nukes, and not on the power of God, is not fearlessness, it is folly. Such pride and arrogance, when not repented of, will incur the judgment of God. It's just a question of when. So, point number one, Belshazzar's arrogance. Point number two, Daniel's courage. Point number three, God's judgment. To our own hostile and precarious times, Daniel chapter 5 offers some sobering guidance. Let me pick out two vital messages. Firstly, choose your leaders with care. Watch out for political slogans that could lead people into idolatry. In times of insecurity, people look for strong leaders. If a leader boasts that they alone can fix things and leaves God out of the equation, they are arrogantly putting themselves forward as a savior. They are inviting misplaced trust and worship. God alone is worthy of worship. Anything else is idolatry. If you think I'm making a political point against someone who's just won a certain presidential election, I'm not. I am talking about spiritual truth that it is imperative we apply as citizens of any democracy. Before you follow a political leader, measure the things they say against biblical principles. It is a fearful thing to risk the judgment of God. Secondly, seek the Lord while he may be found. We none of us know what is around the corner. But there can be remarkable peace in knowing that whatever might befall us, nothing can pluck us from the eternal love of God. When we have submitted fully to Jesus, then fearless living becomes a possibility. The persecuted Christians of our world show us that. But the story of Belshazzar teaches us that God has no grandchildren, meaning that it is not enough to be related to a believer. We can hear the truth and know the truth, but God will judge us on whether we have accepted it for ourselves. God's judgment may not have caught up with us yet, but that is because he is infinitely patient in giving us another chance. However, he is not mocked. So if today you have heard the Lord's voice, don't harden your hearts. Like Belshazzar, we don't know when our soul may be required of us. We should all be prepared for death by making our peace with God now. And if we have already done that, by making our peace with others, wherever it lies with us to do so, then we can rejoice that the blood of Jesus has graciously wiped out the words of condemnation on the walls of our hearts. One final thought as we close. Does God still write on the wall in today's world? And if so, where does he do it? And what might he say? If in Daniel's time he used this scary device to force attention to human disobedience, then let me throw out a speculation for which I have no proof whatsoever. If today the Creator God despaired of our lack of care for his earth and wanted to jerk our attention to the consequences before it was too late, then mightn't he write in the language of nature that he created, in shrinking ice fields and rising sea levels, and in the silent song of disappearing species? Who would know but he? And since it would probably be a hoax, why would we listen anyway?